This is The Source on KSTX 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. On Tuesday, Hillary Rodham Clinton made history by being the first woman in the United States to be nominated for president from a major political party. Tonight, she's expected to officially accept the nomination and put another massive crack in the biggest glass ceiling in U.S. politics. And many are wondering if Clinton's achievement will have any lasting impact with helping to boost the number of women holding elected office in America. 63 of the world's 195 nations have been led by a woman, but it's still not the norm. What are your thoughts about women running for office in America? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at tprsource. We're joined by Sharon Navarro. She is the Associate Professor of Political Science at UTSA. And welcome to The Source, Sharon.
Thank you.
Hillary Rodham Clinton becoming the nominee for a major political party for president, history-making, how big?
Enormous. She has set a number of standards that have been shattered. She is signifying that gender is no longer a barrier to one of the two major political parties, and it may not be a barrier anymore to winning the highest office in the country. Her nomination also signifies that a woman can out-fundraise a male candidate from one of the two major parties, which hasn't been seen before at that high level of office. And it keeps piling on. It also indicates that those that have donated before, 53% of all female donors are donating to Hillary Clinton, as opposed to 28% of Donald Trump's campaign donations. She has surpassed Barack Obama in campaign donations. And when you have women who are donated for the first time to a woman of that high a level of office, it indicates that they are more than likely to donate again. And they are interested in politics, and they are engaged and more likely to run for future offices. And it also indicates that as a female candidate, it is okay to run as a woman candidate, which we have not seen before. Typically, when women run for offices, they have to downplay their feminization as a candidate because it tends to be in conflict with whether or not they can carry out their motherly duties with the expectations of the office. And here we've seen in the past few nights with various speakers that the feminization, the motherhood factor is coming into play to sort of soften her image. And lastly, we see that her nomination signifies to youngsters and boys and girls that having a female elected to office is going to be the norm. It's not a rarity. It's not a novelty. It should be expected.
The fundraising issue, you brought that up immediately. And was it thought that women would have a harder time raising money than men to get to high office?
The research has shown in the past that women tend to face barriers to fundraising. They don't have the same networks. They lack the confidence to get out there. And here she has shown through her various years in office that she can raise the same, if not more. So this is a barrier for that has been broken and makes women feel much more comfortable and gives them the sense that they can go out and raise more money.
Let's bring in another voice into the conversation. Cynthia Terrell is the chair of the Representation 2020 Project, which raises awareness about gender representation disparity among elected office holders. And Cynthia, hi, welcome to The Source. And what do you think about the women running for high office, and they're just as able to raise money as men, it looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. Women have a terrific track record on raising money. I think one of the thing that shows us is that there are other kinds of obstacles to women achieving electoral success at all levels of government, local, statewide, and in the state legislature as well. And the kinds of things that we look at are some of the other rules like recruitment processes and voting systems that have an impact on whether women are able to get elected.
And so, will Clinton's nomination, will that spur or inspire women to become more politically involved, you think, Cynthia?
I absolutely think that it will. My passing interest in being a historian has shown me that it often requires a collection of impetuses for things to change, and our whole history of the United States has been an unfolding effort to create this more perfect union, and having Clinton at the top of the ticket for right now, and all of the work that she'll be doing between now and November, I think will certainly be showing girls in this country that they can aspire to the highest office in the land. But I think perhaps most importantly, it'll be showing the boys as well, that women are just as capable as being leaders in this country. And I think that's an important lesson, that it has an impact on society as a whole, not just young girls.
But Hillary Rodham Clinton is not the first woman to run for president. Elizabeth Dole did it in 2000, former senator, former secretary of transportation. And Geraldine Ferraro was on the vice president candidate in 1980. And we saw Sarah Palin as McCain's vice president pick. So women have had a seat, you know, have had a role for quite a while, Cynthia.
Well, that's true. There have been plenty of women involved in all kinds of levels of politics. And I think that I guess I'm not over-promising. I think it will certainly have a positive impact. If you asked me, will it change things by next January, I would say absolutely not. And I think that we need to do far more than having a handful of role models for all of us. We really need to work hard to figure out the best kinds of systems and practices. When I talk to some groups about this, I often give the example of Title IX, that there was a real interest in the United States in making educational opportunities available to both girls and boys, because girls seem to not get a fair shake in athletics and in education. So we came together as a country. We created rules and systems that are packaged under Title IX that leveled the playing field for girls in education. And I'm proposing that we select a set of packages and reforms that will help level the playing field for women in representation in much the same way that Title IX leveled the playing field for girls in education. And sure, inspiration is important, but also making practical and strategic systems and rules changes that level the playing field are important as well.
Okay, I want to ask you what those specific recommendations are to reform the system in just a bit. We're going to go to break, and we'll be back in a minute. I just want to mention in 1916, Jeanette Rankin was the first woman elected to the U.S. Congress. She was a Republican from Montana, which is interesting because the 19th Amendment, which gave the women the vote, wasn't even passed until 1920. When we can come back, we're going to keep talking about women and the elected to high office and what needs to change and how that could change policymaking in America, not just women in general, but also here in Texas and Latinas and what needs to change. 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Women make up about half of the U.S. population, but less than 20% of Congress. Only one in four state legislators is a woman, and there are only six female governors. Of the top 100 cities in America, 17 are women, and one of them is in San Antonio. But there is no question that there is a gender gap when it comes to electing women to high office in America. Is that going to change? Is it changing? We are seeing Hillary Rodham Clinton accepting a nomination for the Democratic Party tonight. Will that inspire young women, young men to go chase a high office? You know, give us a call. What do you think? 210-614-8980. Sharon Navarro is with us. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at UTSA. So it's not just running for president. It's running for all sorts of things, like mayor of San Antonio. Our most recent mayoral race runoff was between two women, so we had that. So is it changing here locally?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I think research has shown that when you live in metropolitan areas where you have tech-savvy community, you have friendlier districts that are more willing to vote women into office. So cities like San Antonio and other large major metropolitan areas are very similar in many ways. Younger generations are much more open to electing women in a variety of offices, and San Antonio is growing and changing, and we are on the cusp of having a mobile, educationally mobile community. So it won't be unusual anymore in the future.
Cynthia Terrell, when we were speaking to you earlier, you're with the Representation 2020 Project. You said that there should be some reforms, practical changes to the system that could help women achieve higher office. What do you mean?
Well, yeah, we think it's great. A lot of the programs that now focus on training individual women and preparing them and introducing them to politics, we think those programs are terrific. But we also see the need for institutional changes that look at the recruitment process and the voting system and what happens within the legislature to make sure that women are able to run, win, serve, and lead. That's our motto. Specifically, the kinds of recruitment plans that we're thinking of are working with political parties to talk to them about setting targets for the number of women they recruit. We think that there's a good, rich legacy there. Both the RNC and the DNC have, of course, gender parity for their delegates. They have parity for their state committees and much of their internal party leadership. So we think there's a good basis there for a conversation then about the kinds of candidates that the parties recruit. And so being open and public and working with those training groups to say, yes, you know, there are a few open seat races, and we're going to be intentional. We're going to go out and make sure that we recruit women candidates and Latina candidates and other candidates to run in these districts. And so that's step one, I think, is getting political parties to be intentional about stating their intention to recruit women candidates. Another part of that process is getting donors and political action committees to also set targets to commit to a certain number of women candidates whom they're going to pledge their support to. We've seen this mechanism being very impactful in other countries, and we think that there's a great potential to try that here. Then the second phase of it is making sure that we have the best voting systems that are really level the playing field for women candidates. And we, without going into too much detail, we have some pretty antiquated voting systems. I'm sure most Americans have felt some frustration one way or another with the process of voting and our winner-take-all voting system, which can sometimes skew election results and definitely tends to favor incumbents. And as we know, most elected officials in this country are white men, and so a winner-take-all voting system that favors incumbents means that it's a disadvantage for women and non-traditional candidates. So we want to there's some great new voting systems out there, new to this country, that involve electing more than one person for a geographic area and using a ranked-choice voting system.
Like in California.
California, Minneapolis, it's on the ballot statewide in Maine, and it does a couple things. It creates more civility in the campaign process, so women are more likely to run. It mitigates the impact of money and politics so that it incentivizes grassroots organizing, which women tend to be quite good at. And it, of course, produces a majority winner, which is usually a consensus candidate, and That bodes well, I think, for women's leadership. Then the third thing that we think is super important, which has been modeled in some jurisdictions in the United States, are internal legislative measures that make it possible for women to serve and lead effectively. So we all think about the work-life balance in the private sector, but in the public sector and government, I think there's a lot that can be done in terms of offering childcare, in terms of letting elected officials vote virtually so they don't have to travel from their home. And those are the kinds of measures that once women get elected to office, allow them to stay in office and function as parents and daughters and community members, and doesn't jeopardize sometimes those activities that women for the time being, seem to continue to be chiefly responsible for.
All right, let's go to the phone lines. We'll come back to this in just a second, but I want to get a caller in on the air. Jaime is on the line. And Jaime, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. A quick comment. This is a momentous time in history. I am glad to be living in it. I hope that even if Secretary Clinton gets elected or not, this is very important, and I hope that at some point other people and younger people will be able to look at this and say, you know, I remember at that time, and that's what motivated me to take office. And if she does get elected, then we'll make history again for the ages to come. That's it. Thank you very much.
All right, Jaime, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. So let me get back to, our other guest, Sharon Novato, Associate Professor of Political Science at UTSA. Well, what did you think about these recommendations that Cynthia Terrell brought up?
I think they're great. I think I would go one step further with party recruitment. I think it's not only important to have the recruitment, but it's important to have the promises that come with the recruitment. Oftentimes you will have party leaders give the green light to female candidates to run. But when they start that campaign, that support dissipates. I also think that the funding is important, but it's important early on. So you need to have that commitment from the get-go. And I think the other important gatekeeper that our research has shown with respect to minority female candidates running for office are the campaign managers. If you don't have a campaign manager that knows how to run a female candidate and a specific female candidate in a given geographical area, the chances of that female candidate ever making past the running phase is very minimal. In terms of electoral systems, I'm not quite sure what specific recommendations there are. If we're talking about the multi-member district, block, as it is known as a block of voting, or at-large districts, we've already had that in Texas, and it wasn't successful. History has shown that it is particularly marginalizing to minority candidates. And in today's newspaper, at Texas Tribune, there is a lawsuit filed against the electoral system of the state
judges.
Supreme Court. Right. This at-large system really doesn't work because it minimizes a certain sector of the population.
All right. So, but is this situation?
Can I pop in there?
Yeah, go ahead, real quick.
I just want to be clear. I am not advocating for an at-large system in a winner-take-all contest. We are really clear that we are advocating for a ranked choice voting system within the district. And so great examples from the four cities in the Bay Area that use these ranked choice voting systems. I think out of the 52 seats elected, 48 of them are held by women and people of color. Same thing is true in Minneapolis, where I believe the first Hmong American was elected, the first Somali American was elected, a Latina was elected. And the ranked choice voting mechanism really is a great mechanism because it conveys votes into seats much more accurately than the general winner-take-all system. And one of the things I completely agree or appreciate what you're saying. I'm not going to disagree with that at all. But just to clarify, I think that there are situations where there may be more than one.
Right.
In many places where there's more than one key constituency who really wants and deserves representation.
Okay.
And it's hard. Oh, go ahead.
Okay, well, I just want to get to another point. I think we've kind of hit that pretty hard. But, you know, studies have shown that when women run for office, they're just as likely to win as a man. Okay, the issue is getting women to the plate and getting them to step up and run for office and doing the recruitment that you talked about and how that's an important part of this. And some people have wondered if there is a gender gap in political ambition and if that is the problem. So let me get your reaction, Sharon Novato.
The recent literature indicates that there really is no gender gap or any lack of political ambition on part of females. Family used to be perceived as a barrier, but it is no longer a barrier. The biggest barriers, context, political environment, the political culture, the party that dominates the state are huge barriers to women trying to run for office.
Okay, and Cynthia.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a complicated question. It may well be that there are factors that reduce a woman's desire to run or ability to run and so forth, but I think that those will change when there are greater constituencies of women in legislative bodies, and it feels more like the kind of place that women can serve and lead. So, and I think you're right to mention the context is important. Partisan outcomes often determine who's getting elected and so forth. So it's a complicated question, to be sure.
Sure. And there was a Pew Research study that says that looks at that 38% of Americans believe women are held to a higher standard than men, and that is why they don't run for political office. And do we see that as a problem, that they're afraid that they're not, that they're more scrutinized and held to a higher standard, Sharon?
Absolutely. The most recent book we published highlights stereotypes and perceptions of stereotypes and how those carry over to specific ethnic groups and translating into votes. So absolutely, that has a factor in a voter perception, voter outcome.
Cynthia?
Yes, for sure. I agree.
Okay, how do you fix that?
Well, I would say you fix that with intentionality about recruiting candidates to run, and that you incentivize that recruitment in some way. So some of the countries where this is modeled, the party will give money to the local party who has done the best job recruiting women candidates. So there's some incentive for a local party to recruit women candidates and candidates of color. And I think we need to build that culture into our American political culture, where we say, I'm intrigued by the idea, for example, of a replacement mandate. So if somebody, if a woman senator retires from the U.S. Senate, then there's a cultural norm that that candidate be replaced by a woman, or that the party is then has public pressure and internal party pressure to field a strong woman candidate to replace that person. I guess my bottom line is, unless we're intentional, the change isn't going to happen.
Okay, we're out of time. 23 states have never elected a woman governor. Mississippi, Vermont, and Delaware, only 3 states never to send a woman to Congress or the Senate. Sharon Navarro is Associate Professor of Political Science at UTSA. Cynthia Terrell is the Chair of the Representation 2020 Project. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be back after this NPR news break.